This is WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Ezekiel Emanuel writes in his new book, Reinventing American Healthcare, that the Affordable Care Act is a world historic achievement, even more important for the United States than Social Security and Medicare have been. He also writes that the program has been a short-term disaster for President Obama and the Democrats because of the sloppy rollout of the Federal Exchange website, delayed provisions, and the administration's inability to sell it. Emanuel, who is one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, describes the behind-the-scenes politics involved in the program's passage in his book and also makes predictions about trends that are transforming healthcare delivery. He is vice provost for global initiatives and chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. And Ezekiel Emanuel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's a great pleasure and honor to be back here.
Well, thank you very much. If you could start all over again and roll back the clock and know what you know now about the Affordable Care Act, would you have done anything differently or made any different suggestions?
Oh, there are lots of different suggestions to be made, both in substance and in implementation. I think on the substance, I certainly would like to see more payment reform. As I make clear in the book, I think it's essential that we have more payment reform. And what I would have really liked in the bill was a sort of schedule for payment reform and a timeline that everyone could count on. I think that, you know, as I go around the country talking to people, that turns out to be a really important situation. We sort of have a misalignment at the moment. We're still paying largely fee-for-service. 85% or more of payments are fee-for-service, and yet we're also have a situation where we want doctors and hospitals to change how they're practicing, and those things present conflicting messages to doctors. So I think giving a timeline as to how to change would have been very helpful. And I think the two key issues, as you pointed out in your introduction, as I make clear in the book, you know, a better communication strategy around healthcare and what's in the Affordable Care Act, I think could have happened, should have happened. I think it clearly has put everyone behind the eight ball in terms of making the American public understand. One of the reasons for the book, as I make clear, is the fact that lots of people know healthcare is changing but don't understand the direction, don't understand what's in the Affordable Care Act, and I don't think that was necessary. And the second thing is clearly execution wasn't done properly, and that also nothing inherent about the bill that required bad execution. There are clearly some states that have executed, especially on the exchange, well. And I think that, again, more focus and more appreciation of the very important role that just getting it right would have played in convincing the American public this was a very good and positive thing.
And it is so curious, and I think you and I have talked about this before, that this is President Obama's signature achievement, and yet while they worked Congress to get it passed, once it was passed, they didn't sell it. And Massachusetts used celebrities and athletes to sell their version of the Affordable Care Act when it was rolled out in Massachusetts, but not so much by the administration. It's confounding to me.
Well, clearly now we're in a big push, and they are bringing out some key celebrities and others to sell it. But I actually would say even before it got passed, we could have done a better job selling it. It was, after all, August 2009 when a lot of representatives and senators went home for the summer vacation that they got a huge negative response in the town hall meetings and other venues. That was a moment where the sale or not sale of the healthcare reform, I think, sort of took a misstep right from the start. It actually was the birth of the Tea Party right there. And I think if we had done a better job, and, you know, I at that time was in the administration, a better job before that and around that moment, I think it would have helped.
Well, because what happened was the critics got to define what the Affordable Care Act was and got to tag it with this socialist label, for instance.
Well, I don't know that it was so much the social, the government takeover of health care, the death panels, but I think clearly, you know, a good rationale for why we needed the bill and why what it was going to do for people. you know, I think it's always important to contrast what we have with what came before the legislation. I think one of the things people frequently forget is we had 50 million people uninsured. We had 5% of the people going into the hospital getting an infection, with tens of thousands dying from those infections. We had costs going up. The galvanizing factor before the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, WellPoint announced that it was going to increase rates on individuals 39%. Well, that got a lot of people's attention and reminded us of, you know, the system really is terrible. And I think that rationale, the fact that the system was breaking and was not going to repair itself on its own, was the main rationale for the Affordable Care Act. Is the consequence going to be perfect? No. But we've gone in the right direction on every one of those metrics, whether it's access, more people getting coverage. We just saw a Gallup poll released yesterday showing continued drop in the uninsured rate, and especially the 26 to 34-year-old age group. We've seen substantial improvements in quality as a result of the Affordable Care Act. We've seen hospital-acquired infections go down. We've seen medication errors and other things decline, pressure soars, falls in the hospital. And similarly, costs for the last few years have been under control. Now, you know, I worry. Those things won't continue unless we reinvigorate and push harder. But, you know, you have to say those things are important achievements on the way to reforming the system.
Do you think part of the problem is that we're talking about a very complicated system, still a very complicated system, and that people, patients, consumers, they don't know what they have. They don't understand the system. They don't understand their policy. All they know is that if something goes wrong, it's a systemic problem.
Right. Well, we mostly prefer not to pay attention until something goes wrong.
Exactly.
And when we don't, it is a complicated system. It's not easy. As I say, I think in the second or third chapter of the book, there are two people who actually understand the American healthcare system, and both of them are there in their 80s and 90s.
Exactly.
You can't expect the average person to. No. On the other hand, there are things you can tell the average person to make it clear why we actually are reforming the system. Let me just give you one other piece of information that I think is positive. You know, the consequence of the slowdown in healthcare costs means that the premiums paid by seniors for Medicare Part B, that's the outpatient services, and the drug benefit have basically stayed flat for 3 years now. Well, that's a big benefit. I mean, that's a big benefit to seniors. Less money going out of their pocket to health care, more money they can spend on other things. That kind of benefit is it only health care reform that did it? No. There's probably, unfortunately, some consequence of the Great Recession. There are some other changes. But health care reform definitely contributed to that slowdown in costs. And that's a real serious benefit to people. Convincing people, explaining that to people, I don't think it's impossible, but I think it's something that, again, wasn't done optimally.
There's, as you know, many criticisms of the Affordable Care Act, but one is, you mentioned Medicare, why didn't we do Medicare for all? Use that system, just apply it to the entire population. I know that probably sounds easier than it would be in reality, would that have in any way dealt with some of the issues we've been talking about?
Well, there is a simplicity to the idea that you're going to have this one payment system. There's also a rigidity to it. It's hard to change Medicare, even though it's not for everyone, 300 million Americans, because it does consume such a big part of the healthcare system. So reforming it, making changes, much more difficult. Right. I think we don't know the best way to pay for healthcare to get the best result. And I think we do need a lot of experimentation and a dynamic system that can adapt quickly or more quickly. I personally think the idea of Medicare for all is probably not a great idea. I think there are tremendous strengths with the program, but also I think there are weaknesses, and they stem from the same problem. And I think you want some more options. Similarly, I think, let's be honest, just from a political standpoint, it's a non-starter.
It's not going to happen, you're saying.
As Bill Clinton tried, you know, to as the term goes in the tech world, disintermediate the insurance companies, take them out. You're not they're big players, and that isn't going to happen in a political system like ours. That would be as a friend of mine said, you know, that's $800-900 billion industry. You're not removing it, so. You know, we need to be politically realistic. We have been trying, again, as I make clear in the book, we've been trying to reform the system for 100 years. Mm-hmm. We barely got the Affordable Care Act through, adding more and more on it. More changes, more substantial, just was going to be untenable.
And this is sort of at the heart of the Affordable Care Act, the idea of expanding coverage, getting more people into the system, and reducing costs. Do we know today that that can happen, that you can expand coverage and keep costs down or even reduce them? Do we know the answer to that?
Well, we do know that we can, and we know
on
that,
paper?
That no, the last few years we've seen that phenomena. We also know that without constant attention, constant focus on how to adjust the system and identify problems, unintended consequences, and get them resolved, that in fact it will be the case that healthcare costs will go up if we don't constantly address how we're paying doctors, how we're incentivizing hospitals, and things like that. And again, that's we've had a good run now for 3 or 4 years of relatively low inflation. I do fear that if we don't address some of these issues, and healthcare inflation could come back. But the main thing about healthcare inflation is I don't think it actually relates too much in terms of the uninsured rate. We now have a structure to get people insurance. The real problem is that healthcare costs, you know, rob states of money because they have to pay more Medicaid, more insurance for their state workers, of doing other things that are vital to states, like education, like the environment or roads or infrastructure. Similarly, it's a substantial cause of the national debt, and that has its own problems. And so I think one of the important consequences of controlling healthcare inflation actually has manifests itself outside of the healthcare system in these other areas. And, you know, for me, that's actually a primary motivation of wanting to actually get healthcare costs under control to allow us to actually impact these other things, including people's wages.
Well, and I want to pick up on all that, and we're almost up in a break here, and I'm using quotations here, are the right people signing up? And by that, I mean these young, healthy people. You mentioned the younger set, that they looks like they are signing up, but are they signing up in the right numbers?
The last time we peaked, it was at the start of the month, it was about 4 million people signing up. I think the estimate, we'll probably get between 5 and 5.5 million people signing up, less than expected. But we did have two months at the start of a system where you couldn't sign up. But I also think almost all the data suggests that they are the right kinds of kids. We have about 27% young people. It's not really young people you're after. It's healthy people to balance off the sick people.
Right.
It does appear that there's going to be sufficient mix of people signing up that this won't go into a death spiral where rates will go way up and then people will exit. So I think it'll be stable.
And that's Ezekiel Emanuel, our guest today on Radio Times, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, author of a new book called Reinventing American Healthcare. We are talking about the Affordable Care Act, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back.
Burnaby Volvo, minutes away from Northeast Philadelphia in Huntington Valley, supports WHYY and features a large selection of new and pre-owned Volvo models. Their full inventory at burnabyvolvo.com. Burnaby Volvo, 215-947-6363.
Steve, let me ask you something. When you're hosting NPR's Morning Edition, how do you keep all those news stories straight in your head?
By listening. I don't pretend to know all the answers. My job is to know who to ask and how to ask them. At NPR's morning program, our job is to push for real stories, honest answers.
And you can listen with us on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, 3 years after the earthquake and tsunami in Fukushima, Japan destroyed that nuclear power plant, effects are being measured. Japanese officials now admit contaminated wastewater has been flowing into the ocean. Very soon, low levels of radiation will reach the west coast of the U.S. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at pico.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain talking with Ezekiel Emanuel about his new book, Reinventing American Healthcare, about the Affordable Care Act. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We've done a number of programs about the doctor-patient relationship and this whole issue of compliance. And how someone can go to a hospital or even be under a doctor's care and they say, you know, take your medicine, 3 pills, 3 times a day, blah, 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 and they don't do it. Is there anything about the Affordable Care Act that can deal with this issue of I guess, noncompliance?
It is a very big issue, and in part because often taking care of yourself requires a big change in lifestyle. And we all know that we're creatures of habit, and changing our lifestyle is hard. That's why New Year's resolutions often don't get fulfilled.
Exactly.
But I think that one of the projections I make, the megatrends I identify, is that if you want to improve the quality of the healthcare system and really lower costs, the key area to focus on are people with chronic illness, people with heart disease, heart failure, emphysema, diabetes, cancer, hypertension, asthma. These patients, and they're about 10%, use about 2/3 of the healthcare dollars. And if you want to improve quality and you want to control costs, you have to focus on that 10%. And the key way to do that is prevention, not preventing infections or cancer by taking screening tests, but by taking people who have an illness and preventing them from getting sicker, preventing the diabetic patient from getting an infected foot ulcer, preventing the patient with emphysema from having an exacerbation. And I think what we're going to see is health systems much more focus on these patients, intervening early. And the important thing is intervening when they're not in front of the doctor or in the hospital, when they're at home, when they're doing their daily activities. And so I think one of the transformations that I project over the next decade is this more VIP care for these people with chronic illness. You're going to have nurses. You're going to have monitors at home. You're going to have people intersecting with them, whether it's a community healthcare worker or a dietitian or whatever, to try to keep them healthy. And part of that is definitely compliance with medication. So there's a whole series of new medication bottles that alert people. And if patients haven't taken their medication, letting their next of kin or the doctor's office know, so that it's not 2 or 3 days that they go by without taking their medication. It's only a few hours, and then someone can intervene if necessary.
Is the American population any more unhealthy than other populations? You talk about some of these chronic diseases. We know about the problems of obesity. I mean, how much do you think that drives not just the cost of the system, but even the complexity of the system to deal with these sort of public health issues?
Well, there are two components to that question. The first is there's no doubt that smoking, diet, and exercise, 60%+ of our healthcare issues relate to those three items.
Wow.
And so getting those under control and having a lower smoking, better diet, very important from a long-term healthcare standpoint, and even for people who do have serious illness. I mean, if you have emphysema or asthma and smoking, it's just not a good idea.
No.
Smoking around kids is also not a good idea. Conversely, let's be clear, compared to European countries, the United States has a substantially lower smoking rate. We have done better on the smoking phenomena. We're down at about 18-19% of the adult population smoking. We know how to drive that down further in terms of actually raising taxes, and I think President Obama has proposed an increase in the cigarette tax, wants to fund early childhood education. That's probably all good from a health standpoint as well as an education standpoint. I think that's as I make clear in the book, health reform 2.0, that's a leading recommendation I have, because we know if we raise the tax 50 cents, on a pack of cigarettes, we could drive down the smoking rate another 3%.
It just becomes too expensive to smoke.
Yeah, and you also dissuade young kids. I mean, the key thing is if you get through to your sort of early mid-20s not smoking, you're likely never to smoke in your life, and that's an important element. We want kids not to smoke. But we also are worse on obesity. So if you compare us to Europe, we do better on the smoking side, worse on the diet and exercise side. Although, you know, truth be told, Europe is catching up fast.
Lucky them.
The fact is, you know, I always viewed my work in the White House paired. I worked on the Affordable Care Act, but I also worked on the First Ladies Let's Move initiative. And whatever else you want to say, it has changed the conversation in America about food. About obesity, about nutrition, and I do think that that is a major impact. It's an important public health measure, and we've had some recent data. It's early, preliminary. It doesn't indicate it's a long-term trend that young kids are actually less obese, less overweight.
These are the 2 to
5 year
olds.
The 2 to 5 year olds. That's a major finding. Now, it's just one data point. It's not a trend. One needs to see a lot more, but it. You know, just the change in conversation, I think, and the preliminary data, it's not just that data. There's some other data. Actually, Philadelphia schools have released some data that, you know, obesity among kids is down. Those are encouraging signs. We obviously have to push harder. I think the moment we get encouraging data, we should not take our foot off the accelerator. We should push it down harder because we're seeing things that are working. But I think that it does suggest that we're beginning to recognize the problem, beginning to move in the right direction.
Let me ask you another question about just whether we have the right kinds of doctors and nurses, you know, the healthcare professionals. Do we have the right mix of them? Are they distributed in a way that can not only make the Affordable Care Act work better, but also address the needs of the people? Of patients?
Well, a lot of people are worried about the workforce issue. Do we have enough doctors? I actually am not in that crowd. I actually think the doctor shortage is not going to be real, not going to be our major problem. I do think what we have to do is train our healthcare professionals differently. And that's not just doctors, it's also nurses and pharmacists and others.
In medical school, for instance? In medical
school, nursing school, when they're in residency. And at least three major ways. First, you know, patients are complicated now with chronic illness. They're not best cared for by a single doctor with the patient. You need teams that are composed of healthcare workers, community workers, rehabilitation people. And working in a team who does what, that is a new skill. That's not something you were born with. And I think we need to do more training on that. Second, a lot of the training happens still in hospitals. So medical school students, they rotate through hospitals. Interns and residents, they take care of patients in hospitals. Well, increasingly, care is going to be out of the hospital. It's going to be done remotely. We've got to train our doctors and nurses for that kind of world. We can't wait for that world to happen and then begin to train people. That obviously has a problem. It's a little more complicated to put doctors in offices or home visits, but we have to figure out how to do that. And the third thing is a lot of what doctors are doing is managing. They're managing a team. They're managing complicated interactions. They're leading strategic initiatives to transform care. We need docs to have more management skills. So places that are training doctors, I think, have to link up with their sister business schools and begin figuring out what's the right combination of management skills for doctors who are going to confront this different kind of world. And I don't think we really thought that through. So while I don't think it's really surely a numbers game, I do think it's a skills game. And the last thing I would say is, you know, we're going to see a very, very big increase in telemedicine or distance wireless connectivity. It's not only on the telephone, but it's going to be scales that are linked to directly wirelessly transmitting data. It's going to be glucose monitors. It's going to be breathing. So you do your breath test, immediately your doctor or the healthcare team will see it. And those kind of connections and analyzing them and keeping track of them on a large number of patients, that is going to be the wave of the future. You know, I saw
That's okay.
Kaiser introduce really using your smartphone, take a picture of a rash, send it to a dermatologist. You don't have to go see the dermatologist, right? Increase the amount of patients a dermatologist could see 50%.
Wow.
Because a lot of those rashes can be easily diagnosed by a picture. You don't actually have to go in. Again, I see that as proliferating, and that will increase productivity and bring costs down for a visit.
And that is Ezekiel Emanuel, our guest today on Radio Times. I have called him, as others have, one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, the subject of his new book called Reinventing American Healthcare. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Jerry from Northeast Philly to join us. Jerry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
I was just calling real quick. I'm on the Affordable Health Care Act. I'm 62 years old. I'm a diabetic. I have a defibrillator. And I was on COBRA, and it cost me $680 a month after the first year went up to almost $1,000.
Wow.
But the one comment I want to make, there's a lot of misinformation out there about the Affordable Health Care Act, and it's worth the phone call. I went to my congressperson. They told me to call their number, and my benefit package that I received through the Affordable Health Care Act is similar to my own Cigna policy that I had that went into my COBRA, and it's cheaper.
It is cheaper.
And my coverage and my plan is, I'm saving a few dollars here or there, but it's almost identical. And I think people who are really questioning the Affordable Health Care Act, call the 800 number, get the information. The people I spoke to on the phone, when they answered, were nothing but helpful. They made it so simple, so easy. And I think it should be advertised better than what it's been.
Well, there's so much misinformation.
I'm sorry.
No.
What a great PR for the Affordable Care Act. I'm sure President Obama would love to hear what you just said. But I do think, again, this is part of the communication strategy issue, which is for a lot of Americans, the Affordable Care Act will be a better bargain. Either it'll be the same and the benefit package will be better. It'll be the same both benefit package and premium, but you're guaranteed it. They can't take it away. I was in New York last week, and the guy at the radio station told me, I went on to the exchange in New York and saved $300 a month. And I hear this very frequently. You can't just look at the sticker price. You have to look at the sticker price minus the subsidy that the government's going to give you for buying. And for a lot of people, that's going to be a better deal. Plus, you get choice. And for many Americans, again, even if their employer has given them insurance, typically they don't have choice. And on the exchange, there will be a choice of a number of plans and also plans in different tiers. So I think that is definitely a good advertisement. Thank you very much.
Jerry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And speaking of sticker price, there is such variability, as we know, when it comes to pricing. It's very confusing. And you include even in your book sort of, who pays what for what.
Right.
Why can't we just have a retail price and leave it at that? Why do we have seven prices for something?
Well, so this is one of the complexities of the healthcare system. First of all, it's exceedingly expensive. I open with Erin, a single mother in Colorado who unfortunately had some stomach pain, and it turned out, God forbid, it was colon cancer, and now it's been removed, and she has no evidence of disease. But that operation, 6 days in the hospital, was $70,000. Now, none of us can just write a check for $70,000. That's why we have health insurance. This came out of the blue for her, and for many of us, it could come out of the blue. So it's just a high-cost issue. Then there are, as you point out, six, seven different prices. Actually, there's more than six or seven. I just classify six or seven. There's the charge. That's the sort of sticker price that no one really pays unless you're paying out of pocket. You're an Arab sheik coming for treatment. Then there's the Medicare price. Then there's the commercial insurance. So if you have Independence Blue Cross or you have Aetna, that's each of them will have a different price. They'll negotiate. There's a Medicaid rate, which tends to be low. There's the reasonable cost, which is what happens when an insurance company doesn't have a contract with the hospital and they decide what they're going to pay. All of these prices are crazily different.
Yep. And then there's the actual cost.
Right, which no one knows for most everything, which is what does it actually cost to do this, because we haven't done the kind of studies that'll define clearly the cost of the operation or the procedures. And that is one of the insanities of the system. And the worst part of it is, if you have no health insurance, you get charged the highest price. You have no bargaining power. And that has to change. And there are places like Maryland that has actually done a very good job about changing that. It's one price for everyone, whether you're Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance, you pay out of pocket. And that's, I think, an advantage.
We have an email from Patricia, sort of related to what we're talking about. Wouldn't a bill to force price transparency on providers be an easy vote in Congress? I mean, I don't think anything is an easy vote in Congress these days, but is that an issue that has legs, you think?
Absolutely. I think that issue has a lot of legs. I think we are going to see a lot more price transparency over time. I think the public's going to demand it because they are going to increasingly pay for some things out of pocket with deductibles, and they're going to want to know what the price is. In addition, there are experiments out there in California. The big retired state worker plan called CalPERS has said we're going to do what's called reference pricing. We found a number of places that do knee replacements, and here's the price we're going to pay. I forget what it is, $22,500. It may be more, maybe less. And if you want to go to one of these places, great. We'll pay the whole bill. If you want to go to a place that's more expensive, you like the surgeon, you think it's a better care, whatever your rationale, we'll pay $22,500, and you pay the rest, whatever that delta is. And I think that's going to be a wave of the future, and that's going to make people say, well, look, you know, I want to know what the price is. By the way, knowing the price doesn't tell you enough. You need to know the quality. And so I'll want the price and I'll want the quality, and then I'll make a decision how I'm going to trade these things off. I think that'll have some downward price pressure, and it'll also really begin everyone competing on, you know, showing that they're higher quality. So I think that's a good thing.
Let me get Laurel from Haddonfield, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Laurel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How are you? Good. I just wanted to point out that, first of all, this is great, this legislation. It's a great step in the right direction. Tiny steps, I will say, but better than one step back, giant step back. The real big problem we're going to face, and nobody wants to talk about, because it's, you know, we've been through too much politically, is the cost. Yeah, there's some stuff you can do for the real low income, but, you know, we pay $1,200 a month. And I can tell you, I still get stuck with bills, and they're not small. $1,200 for a minor sprained ankle and one ultrasound, not cancer. Okay, my brother-in-law had cancer, $100,000 in the hole, bankrupt. You can go bankrupt just as easily with $50,000, $100,000, as much as $400,000. And so eventually, as the baby boomers retire, and we start seeing this, because, you know, people can afford what they can afford, and it leaves with a lot less care. One example. Sleep apnea, $15,000 diagnostic care. Can't get it. It doesn't covered. So
yeah.
You
don't, I hear you.
Don't care.
No,
I think eventually, this is so good because it's a step in the right direction.
Right.
And eventually, I think as the baby boomers retire, we'll see that 50% of all bankruptcies are severe illness, but most of that group had insurance, and we're going to see changes there, hopefully.
Well, so, we'll see. Yeah, go ahead, Zeke.
It is the case that a large portion of bankruptcies are related to health care. It's also the case that when you give people insurance, whether it's Medicaid or private insurance or Medicare, the bankruptcy and the financial being wiped out financially by health care actually drops precipitously, mostly because there's a limit to how much you're required to pay. It's called the out-of-pocket maximum. And I do think that with insurance and the benefits required by the Affordable Care Act, we will see the bankruptcy related to health care really drop substantially. And the second part of your question is, we do need cost control. We need to keep the costs down so that it isn't, you don't get an ultrasound and a little something in the emergency room for $1,500. That is not acceptable.
Laurel, thanks for the call. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Ezekiel Emanuel about his new book, Reinventing American Healthcare. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
feeling overwhelmed by the demands of being a working parent? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bridget Schulte about her new book, Overwhelmed. It draws on research into time management and stress, considers how couples share responsibilities, and how employers and the government have dealt or not dealt with the number of working women and men who need time for their children. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
One successful guy says he's just getting started.
If we live longer and we're healthier, we can solve all the economic problems by simply changing the retirement age to age 75.
Genomics pioneer Craig Venter on longevity. Is aging a problem that can be solved with brute force scientific muscle? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. And if you're just joining us, Ezekiel Emanuel is our guest. He's Vice Provost for Global Initiatives, also Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He worked with the Obama administration on the Affordable Care Act, the subject of his new book called Reinventing American Healthcare. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I was particularly interested in these mega trends that you write about. One of them is that accountable care organizations are going to essentially replace traditional health insurance companies.
Well, how
would that work?
It's part of an evolution. Actually, accountable. I think of accountable care organizations as a bit like Neanderthal, a sort of stage in the evolution. They're not the end.
Knuckle dragging.
They're not the end stage. But we are seeing healthcare organizations that are paid to take care of patients from really start to finish. And we're going to see a lot more of this growth over time. Medicare has over 200 of them. Private insurers have contracted with over 200 of them. And they're all across the country. And what they're doing is figuring out how to care for the whole patient across every place, whether it's at home, in the office, at the hospital, in a rehabilitation facility. And soon, many of them are going to begin offering their own insurance. And they're going to list themselves on the exchange. And they're going to contract with employers. And they're going to become what I call integrated delivery systems, kind of like Kaiser, that takes the premium and provides all the care and has a network of doctors and a network of hospitals. And I think that's you can already see there are lots of examples of that around the country. Long Island Jewish in New York has listed itself on the exchange. In Boston, Partners has bought a insurance company. In Albuquerque, the Presbyterian system has contracted directly with Intel to take care of all of its workers. So incipient cases around the country, and I think that's going to grow. I wouldn't be surprised if it begins to happen here in Philadelphia area. Similarly, the insurance companies are going to have to react to that, and I think the way they're going to react to it is beginning to not just pay hospitals, but actually set up networks, employ them in many cases, and they're going to offer the whole kit and caboodle too. They're going to offer the insurance product along with the healthcare provision, hospitals and doctors. And you already see that happening where big insurers have bought providers. United Healthcare employs 5,000 primary care doctors in 75 markets. That is going to proliferate also. And so I think the old model of an insurer taking the premium and paying a doctor or paying a hospital or paying a pharmacy, I think that's going to go by the way. My date for that is 2025. So it's a decade away. It's not going to happen immediately, but you're going to see the evolution over the next decade.
And do you think related to this, as you say, the end of employer-sponsored health insurance, that that's sort of baked into some of these changes?
Yeah, there are two different trends here. So I think, as I like to say to people, you know, you get your insurance from HYY. Well, there's no law requiring HYY to give you insurance. Why do they give you insurance? Well, you wouldn't work here without it. It's harder for you to get insurance than for HYY to put together all their employees and buy a commercial product. With the exchanges, that changes the equation because suddenly, well, you might not. You now have a place to go where if you had cancer, it doesn't matter. If you're older, it doesn't matter that much. And you have an easy way of getting insurance. Well, a lot of employers are going to say, look, health insurance, that's not my strong suit. Why don't I either give my workers, I pay $10,000 for a family plan, I'm going to give them a voucher for $10,000, and they go into the exchange and decide what insurance they want, and I'm out of that game. Or I'll give you a big pay increase, $10,000 pay increase. You go to, you know, and I require you to get insurance out of the exchange, and that's up to you which one you get, how much additional you want to pay. And that, I think, will be a better situation for everyone. You won't be tied to your job because of insurance. You'll have choice in the exchange. The exchange will be a more stable place with more people buying. You'll have premiums that are more stable, and you'll have a lot more choice. A lot of, I don't know how much choice you have here at HYY, but, you know, at Penn, I basically have two choices. The exchange, you have a lot more choices at various different payment levels and benefit levels. And so I think that's the wave of the future.
Does that make then health insurance closer to car insurance? I mean, people are on their own to figure out what kind of car insurance they want, deductibles, all of that.
Yeah, but I think, again, one of the great benefits of the Affordable Care Act is that it standardizes policies. And in some places like California, they've really taken standardization seriously. If you're a silver plan, here's the kind of deductibles you can have. Here's the kind of copays you can have. And so you're really comparing plans on which hospitals are in, what's the benefit structure in terms of what's covered, what's not. And I think that actually will make it easier for Americans to compare these plans. And I'm sure that there are some really smart entrepreneurs thinking, oh, what's the app I can do that'll make people say, all right, you have this illness. Here's how much you spent on healthcare last year. Here's the best combination of premium out-of-pocket expenditures for you to minimize your costs and maximize your benefits. And I think that's probably coming in a year or two.
Let me get back to our callers. We have, it looks like Andrew calling us from Center City, Philadelphia, actually talking about what we were just talking about. Go ahead, Andrew. You're on the air.
Yes, I actually partly answered my question
yes.
there.
Yes, stole your thunder. Yes.
I would like to just add something, though, and that is, It's a wonderful end. I would love to see that and be shopping for it myself. But one thing Obamacare did not address was the disadvantage in paying it for yourself. Because if my employer were to give me the $10,000 that Mr. Emanuel was just talking about, that's all taxable income to me.
That's right.
Versus when my employer buys it, it isn't. And I'm just curious why, when they were putting the Affordable Care Act together, why did they not address that discrepancy? Because it's very unfair, and it's actually a subsidy for the rich.
Those are all really good points, Andrew. I'm glad you raised them. Go ahead, Zeke.
Well, at various points in the book, I talk about the development of what you're describing, which is the tax exclusion, came in 1954, and basically it said, well, when the employer gives you this benefit, you don't pay income tax or payroll tax on that benefit. And in the 1950s, it was a low level, and it wasn't very much money. Today, it's the single largest tax break in the tax code, worth $250 billion, $250 billion. And as you point out, it's very regressive. The rich get much more of that benefit than the poor. Many of us find that unconscionable. We could not get rid of it. There is a cap in the Affordable Care Act that's due to come into effect in 2018 called the Cadillac tax. That is, if you have a super high-end gold-plated plan above a certain level, it'll be taxed at 40%, and your sponsor, your employer, will pay for it. It just wasn't going to be possible to add to that for individuals buying the insurance. But here's the two advantages. One, I think there's probably a way of structuring those vouchers. If your company gives you a voucher to go buy in, that will be still protected as a part of the tax exclusion. And second of all, if you don't get, right, if you get a pay increase and you go buy it yourself, most Americans will get a subsidy through the government, because they will not have employer-sponsored insurance. They'll be in the exchange buying it for themselves, and they will be eligible for a subsidy. Remember, subsidies kick in if your family makes an income of currently $94,000 or less. You get some kind of subsidy. So I think, yes, you won't have the tax exclusion benefit, but you will have a benefit of a subsidy. And I think that's, you know, probably the way to go. And once we get to steady state, I sort of make the prediction that by 2025, only about 20% of workers in the private sector are going to actually have employer-sponsored insurance. I think people will get used to it. And I might add one more thing. You know, young people are used to buying everything online. They're used to buying clothes, their computers, cars, clothing, you know, shoes, insurance. And so I think for them, this switch is like, you know, going to be invisible.
A no-brainer. Thanks for the call, Andrew, to Radio Times. Let me get, looks like Nicole from Queen Village to join us. Nicole, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I just wanted to share a story. I'm a freelance journalist, and I often travel between Manhattan and Philadelphia. I was on a train not too long ago, and I sat next to a gentleman who turned out to be one of the head of Vanguard Fixed Income Group, and he was talking to me about the healthcare system and railing against it, about how people's plans are getting canceled right and left. And I said, well, actually, my plan got canceled, but I have the letter right here with me, and I brought it out of my bag, and I said, it says it's canceled here, but if you read just below, it says it's being replaced. And it turns out it's been replaced with a plan that is both better and less expensive. And when I presented him with this tangible evidence, instead of him saying, oh, or considering possibly that he was incorrect, he snarled, well, it better be good because I'll be on the healthcare system one day too. And this is a gentleman who was millions of dollars, and is simultaneously refusing to accept the truth, but also intending to take advantage of the system that it turns out to work. And,
well, that's... well, Nicole, I appreciate that anecdote because I think there are people, and they're not necessarily all rich people, who just believe the worst about this. There's nothing you can say, Zeke, to change their mind.
Well,
they have made up their mind.
Right. And again, this goes back to the communication strategy, is how do you color people's views? And at some point in the book, I note that, you know, we had the charge about death panels from Sarah Palin and colleagues, you know, clearly wrong, clearly shown multiple times by all sorts of fact checkers in the media, you know, just not anywhere in the bill, nothing even vaguely related to what they're saying. And still, polls show 31% of Americans think death panels are in the bill. So once you get a perception, it's very hard to dissuade people, even with hard facts, right, that their view is wrong. I also think that we see a lot of ideology around the Affordable Care Act that are sort of independent of the facts. A clear case of this is the Medicaid expansion issue, which is hot in many states. The fact is, the federal, you know, when we structured the bill to, you can't force states to expand Medicaid, but you can make it in their interest financially. That's the way the bill's structured. So for the first 3 years, 2015, 2016, states, 100% of the expansion money is covered by the federal government, and then it goes down to 90% gently towards the end of the decade. That's a huge deal for every state. For one thing, they're not subsidizing for the uninsured. For another thing, the sort of cost shift that the increase in the premiums of their state workers because of hospitals charging more to cover the uninsured, that'll go down. Every state that it's been looked at will save money, even states that have very skimpy Medicaid packages. And, you know, the fact is, every state should adopt this. It's in their financial interest. So the only reason we have a large number of states not adopting it is ideology. And that's not, it seems to me, something that's so easy to break, even when you show people, look, you're going to make more money this way. It's going to be better for the population because you'll have everyone covered. It's going to be better for your hospital so they won't have to provide all this free care. And yet we have serious resistance on it for political and similar reasons. And I think, I do think that will slowly erode. And similarly, I think your gentleman, his view will slowly erode as people see the advantages of the Affordable Care Act.
Well, it seems you can find an anecdote to prove any point that you want to make. Nicole, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You talk about where some of the real cost drivers are, some of these chronic conditions, but also, as we know, the end of life is where a lot of money is spent in our healthcare system. And, you know, do we have the kind of tools to address that? And, if you know, I think many of us have been through that, where you're dealing with a dying parent and you're trying to figure out what is the right thing to do, and it's often unclear that you know what to do.
First of all, let's set the table correctly. While there is a lot of money spent at the end of life, it's nowhere near what I would suspect most of your radio audience thinks. Some people say it's 30, 40, 50, 70% of your total healthcare costs. It's 10% of the total healthcare spending, roundabout, is going to end-of-life care. That's a lot of money,
yep,
because it's less than 1% of the population, but it's not huge. It's not 50% of the cost. Second, we were thinking, and there was never in a bill, never written down, of ways that we might improve the system. And as I've written, I think that there are things that can happen. I think it's important to train all doctors and nurses about how to talk to patients about end-of-life care issues. I can tell you that when I practiced oncology and took care of patients and had a lot of patients who were dying of cancer, that's the hardest conversation
sure,
you have. It's
sure.
nothing you want to run into. It's you're not going to feel great at the end. Even when it goes well, it's always tragic. And I think in those situations, teaching people how to communicate about it is really important. Second, we need to make sure that people have access to palliative care, both in the hospital and, just as importantly, if they want to be at home. And that's something that we don't have in this country. There's no requirement hospitals have palliative care services. I think that's a mistake. And I think, similarly, we need to have access in every community in the country to palliative care services in the home so that doctors can discharge a patient confident that they'll get good care in the house. And I think those would go a long way towards making it better. Let me end. I've been working on, have worked on end-of-life care since the early to mid-1980s. Now, sometimes we look at it as, wow, you know, we haven't progressed. There's still all these problems. But I prefer to look at it as if, you know, optimistically, it's very different today than it was in the 1980s. And let me just give you two sort of points on that. When I was began writing, about 70% of cancer patients died in the hospital. It's now under 25%. That's a huge shift. We have learned more than half of patients who are dying of cancer get hospice care. We have learned something. Are we great? No. There are still many patients getting it too late. Second, the whole attitude around end-of-life care has changed. When I went off in the mid-1980s to do my PhD on end-of-life care, the dean basically said to me, oh, you know, that's a dead end. That's no career. We're having frank discussion. We can talk on the radio.
Yes, we can.
In the mid-80s, we couldn't talk on the radio about end-of-life care, certainly not at a cancer center. Every cancer center has a palliative care service. Every cancer center has discussions about this, has, you know, groups. So that's big progress in America. We're not there yet, and we have to do more, but it's big progress.
Ezekiel Emanuel, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Times.
It's wonderful.
And nice to have you with us. Also nice to hear from our listeners as well. And again, the book is called Reinventing American Healthcare. And our guest, Ezekiel Emanuel, speaking at noon today at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to keep the conversation going. You can leave a comment on our homepage, our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter. You can download podcasts. That's WHYY.org/Radio Times. And do stay with us for hour two coming up next. Stay with us. We'll be right back.